Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 16th of April. We have two guests this hour. One will give us national news and one will give us state news. E.J. Dionne is our first guest. He writes about politics in a twice-weekly column in the Washington Post and on the Postpartisan blog. He's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, a government professor at Georgetown University, and a frequent commentator. You hear him on National Public Radio, and he's on ABC's This Week and NBC's Meet the Press. He's a prolific writer. He's written Sold Out, Reclaiming Faith and Politics After the Religious Right, Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge, and a number of other books. And we have a lot to talk to him about this morning. We'll be welcoming phone calls for EJ. Later in the hour, the Madison Bureau reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Patrick Marley, will be joining us. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. Talk@WPR.org. Good morning, EJ.
Oh, it's great to be with you always. I'm sorry I can't hang around to hear Patrick Marley, since politics in your state is more interesting than almost anywhere in the country. And I want to apologize in advance. If you hear barking, our dog gets very excited when other dogs walk by the house, and there's nothing I can do about it. So
it's perfectly all right. I have a dog like that as well. It's nice to hear. I love dogs, EJ, so you just warmed my heart.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
I do hope.
She's a great one. She's a rescue. We think part chow and part golden.
Oh, how nice.
Dog.
How nice. Well, you can always go to our website and hear Patrick later, but you're right. It's going to be a very interesting couple months here in Wisconsin. Let's start with Mitt Romney. You wrote a piece recently about his private self and his public self. Is he going to be presenting himself as a more moderate candidate?
Well, I think it's a very tricky problem, both for him and for President Obama's campaign. That little blog post came out of a line in a Fred Barnes column. Fred Barnes, the conservative writer, was offering some advice to Romney, and one piece of advice was he needed to moderate what he's been saying about immigration. And then he had a little line in there that said a Romney aide or advisor had told him that privately his views are more moderate than they sound. And you know, that raises all kinds of questions, which is, well, what are his real views? Well, we know what his real views are. I think strategically what Romney would love to do is to tell conservatives he's really with them, and those would be the public statements, but to have more moderate voters think that, well, he's saying that because he has to look at the Romney who was governor of Massachusetts. He's actually more moderate. And I think before the campaign is out, we're going to have to know more about which Romney is the real Romney, if there is, you know, to what extent there is one. And then, but this poses a strategic challenge for Obama, because they want to go after Romney as very right-wing, a supporter of your Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan's budget, and they're going to use a lot of his very conservative statements from the primaries against him, yet they also want to run against him as a flip-flopper. But if they run against him as a flip-flopper, they will, in a sense, feed that moderate narrative and encourage people to say, well, he doesn't really believe all this. So it's going to be, I think it's an interesting challenge, let us say, on both sides. But I think at some point, I think it is legit to ask, you know, I'm an opinionated columnist, I'm a liberal, but I think for mainstream journalism, it's going to be a legitimate question to pose to Romney, you know, if they leak out there are these other private views, well, how are we to make sense of that as voters and citizens? This is not unique to Romney, but I think because he's been on a lot of sides of a lot of issues, it's a particular problem for him.
Right. He was the headliner at the NRA convention in St. Louis on Friday. I want to talk a little bit about the enormity of that convention, covering some 7 acres, the few protesters who were outside who were witness to the massacre in Arizona, and couple that with this whole discussion we're having in this country about profiling, about people who are neighborhood watch, people having guns and maybe they shouldn't. Does it behoove him to cozy up to the NRA? And the second question is, why don't we have a real serious conversation about when guns should be used in this country, and will the Trayvon Martin case prompt that conversation?
Well, I hope it does. And I think one of the sad things is that a lot of liberals and Democrats have been intimidated into sort of backing off this issue and leaving the whole discussion to the pro-gun side, or what I view is the anti-rational regulation side. President Obama certainly has not been aggressive on this issue. The irony, as Steve Kornacki, who writes for Salon.com, noted, is Obama is being cast by the NRA as anti-gun, even though he's actually done virtually nothing on the issue. So
right.
Perhaps people who advocate some reasonable restrictions on the use of guns, an end to stand your ground laws, they might as well speak out anyway, because the NRA is going to go after anyone who is vaguely progressive as harboring a secret agenda against them. I think that if you're on the side that says, wait a minute, we ought to have laws against assault weapons, there's nothing wrong with treating gun owners the way we treat people who need licenses to drive cars. And I think at this point, the folks on the on the NRA side and their allies have really gotten into very extreme ground. Those of us who want more rational gun laws, we don't want people in rural areas to have to disrupt their culture. We're not for disarming the entire country, whereas I think the other side is pushing aggressively to make guns, push guns into every part of our life. The Stand Your Ground law is a perverse incentive for everyone to be armed, because in any street confrontation, the balance of power, because of these laws, shifts to the person who's armed. And wherever you stand on the Trayvon Martin case, that's clearly what happened down there with tragic results. There's talk of allowing college students to be armed. Do we really think our college campuses would be safer if all students carried guns on college campuses? I don't think most Americans believe that. So I think those of us on the regulation side, I think, have pretty moderate positions. And I think it's time to expose the other side, parts of the other side. There are perfectly good people who own guns, and we're not against them. We just think that some of these laws are getting very, very extreme, and they really want all of us who choose not to be armed to have to pick up a gun. And I don't think that is the American way.
Well, what's the story with the Democrats on this issue? It seems as though the only person who's come to national prominence was James Brady, a Republican.
Right. Well, you did have, I mean, it should be remembered that President Clinton pushed through some gun laws, including the restriction of the assault weapons ban. And Democrats, a lot of Democrats, analyzed the results of both the 94 elections and the 2000 election and said, we were really hurt, we, the Democrats saying this, were really hurt by our support for gun control. And so we're not going to make those mistakes again. We're going to back off our support for gun control. I think there's also a simple fact, which is the United States Senate is stacked in favor of rural states. The two Dakotas, I love the Dakotas, but the two Dakotas have the same number of senators as California and New York. So for political reasons, the part of the country that tends to be most sensitive about any restriction on guns is vastly overrepresented in Washington. That's another piece of it. Now, I think if you look carefully at these election returns, blaming the Democrats' defeats primarily on guns, I think it's just on their stand on guns, is just a mistake. But there's been great, great fear within the Democratic Party, which is why, and in my column today I call attention to them, I really respect this group called Mayors Against Illegal Guns that was really organized by Mayor Bloomberg in New York, Mayor Menino in Boston. I believe your Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett has been active in it. Where they are saying, look, we're for the Second Amendment, too, but there are things we need to do to keep the streets of our cities safe. We're not asking rural people to make vast concessions in their way of life, but we are asking them to understand what's happening on the streets of so many American cities, large and small. And I hope those guys and the police chiefs and others can give voice to an alternative view to the NRA's that, again, I keep stressing, is not against rural culture or the people in rural areas. It's just trying to have a more rational approach to guns that really characterizes almost all of the other major democracies in the world.
Well, I'm glad you brought up mayors, because I want to talk about Newark Mayor Cory Booker.
Oh, God bless him. Isn't he amazing?
I can't believe what a wonderful story. And has it brought enough national attention to him? And do you know, can you fill us in more on other acts of heroism or how he's run the city of Newark and why he hasn't come to more national attention?
Well, he has over time gotten national attention, and I think we're going to see more of him. For those who didn't see the story, Mayor Booker was being held back by, there was a house on fire, and he was being held back by his security officer. And he said, no, there's a woman yelling in there. And he ran into the house, saved a woman. This is sort of a mayor delivering for his constituents, boy.
Right.
He suffered second-degree burns, but right. He's okay. And it's a remarkable act just to see that. To see a human being, any human being, do that. It's remarkable that he's a mayor. There is a documentary, actually, I was talking about this with someone over the weekend, on his kind of anti-machine campaign when he first ran for mayor, that's very affecting. And he's somebody who's actually won a lot of respect across the political spectrum, and I am quite convinced we are going to hear more from him nationally. You could imagine his running for governor of New Jersey. You could imagine his being a U.S. senator. As I say, he is a Democrat, but he's a Democrat who has gotten on well with quite a number of conservatives. So he's a very, very interesting figure.
He has a lot of guts. He sure does. It was a remarkable story. You don't hear much news that makes you think, what a good guy. What an amazing thing to do. And that indeed was. We're going to welcome phone calls for EJ, and we'll take them right now, as a matter of fact. EJ Dionne is our guest the first half hour of the program. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, syndicated columnist at the Washington Post. You hear him always on Fridays on All Things Considered, and you see him on television. He's all over the place. Let's start our call.
Keep his mouth shut, some would say.
But your dog is being very polite.
Yeah, so far no one has been walking a dog.
Okay.
So that's good.
Willem in Colfax, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Morning, sir.
I think what's happened is that the Republican Party, or what used to be the Republican Party, has been taken over by this extreme right-wing group of people, and any moderates are threatened with the lack of support if they, veer away from this right-wing agenda. And former counsel to the President of the United States, John Dean, has written a book called Conservatives Without Conscience, and I think that's what he's talking about, the people like Karl Rove and other people who seek to destroy our government. And there was an English book called The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Society Stronger. David Cameron, the conservative leader of England, said that we all know in our hearts that as long as there is deep poverty living systematically side by side with great riches, we all remain the poorer for it. And I think that's... I feel like they've really hijacked the Republican Party, and they've even hijacked the term conservative, because they're not conservative. What's conservative about taking taxpayer dollars and redistributing it to private companies?
EJ.
First of all, I love doing your show because you have really smart callers, and that includes the people who call in to disagree with me. But first, I'm glad you mentioned the spirit level. I think this is an argument that progressives really need to make more powerfully, which is the point of an egalitarian, more egalitarian society, not a totally equal society, but having somewhat more economic equality, is not greed or envy. It's that societies that are a little more equal tend to be happier. People in those societies, including the rich people, tend to be happier, more contented, partly because I don't think any of us really wants to live in a society of haves and have-nots. We're all better off when people have opportunity to rise up and kids are taken care of and have decent schools, et cetera. So thank you for that. And the second point is, yes, I think that we really have to come to terms with the fact that this is not the same Republican Party that existed even 10 years ago. If I can plug in advance, and I hope I can come on your show and talk about it, I have a book coming out in about a little over a month, called Our Divided Political Heart. And I argue that from the beginning of our republic, We Americans have been torn by a healthy tension between our love of individualism and our quest for an affection for community. And we tend to tell our story almost entirely on the individualistic side. But we are both of these things, and we are best when we keep both of these things in balance. And I think the conservative movement used to have a very strong communitarian component. There were a lot of conservatives who called themselves compassionate conservatives. Now, those of us who were liberals had some fights with them, arguments with them, and said, well, you're not really putting enough money behind this. Nonetheless, they were committed to the idea that a society that thinks more about community and the common good is a better society. They have been driven to the margins or out of the Republican Party altogether. And I may have said this before on your air. My dirty little secret is that I was a high school liberal Republican. It's hard to imagine anything more boring to be in high school than a liberal Republican. But I miss those guys very much, people like Javits and Brooke and Mathias. There were a whole list of Republicans who were moderate or progressive, and they're losing primaries all over the country. I think it's a loss to the Republican Party, and I think it's a loss to the country.
So how did you move from liberal Republican to how do you identify yourself now?
I'm pretty much I'm a Democrat. I'm a registered Democrat. I'm a liberal. I call myself, actually, in the book, I talk about you could legitimately call me a liberal, and I use the term more and more as the term gets discredited because I think liberals ought to stand up for the honorable history. In some ways, I'm a social Democrat. I'm center-left, but the term I most identify with was actually applied to me by the National Review, the conservative magazine, when they reviewed an earlier book of mine. They call me a communitarian liberal, and that's kind of how I think of myself. So I've always, the National Review often disagrees with me, but I've always been grateful to them for that label.
E.J. Dionne is our guest, the first half of All Things Political. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. He wrote, I think, he's always thoughtful, but an interesting piece on the Supreme Court and health care reform. I want to talk to him about that, and our lines are jammed, so we'll get to as many more calls as we can. You may want to use the email address because our lines are filled. That's talk@WPR.org. Brett Jaspers is answering phone calls. He's still pretty new to us, so be sure and welcome him to the great state of Wisconsin, where he has arrived from New York. All right, more phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second part of this hour, we'll be speaking with Patrick Marley, who is Madison Bureau reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Hugh in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. When I was young, I guess I was a progressive. I remember 1960. Jackie Robinson, I heard him at a civil rights thing in the South. He was plugging for Richard Nixon as opposed to John Kennedy. Martin Luther King was there, too. He was for Kennedy, and in the end, I voted Democrat. Even though, of course, on the state level, the Democrats are the party of legalized segregation. And because
in the
of
South,
my,
it should be noted, sir, right? In other words, that was absolutely right in the South.
Thank God we had easy gun laws and my father could get a gun because you can't always protect on the police. The government is sometimes your enemy or at least not willing to protect you. And when you realize that even today you have flash mobs that run around and beat up people and sometimes kill, the flash mobs will do that. If they knew people were armed, they would be less likely to do so. And in Wisconsin, in a Milwaukee suburb, you had a case of some drunken teenagers. The police come. Of course, as far as I'm concerned, it's a stupid law that says you have to be 21 to drink. But that is a law. The people fled the police. One wants to break into somebody's home at 2 a.m., and the owner shoots him and kills him. And, of course, so you have another Trayvon nonsense thing. He was
nonsense thing.
Do you call the owner of the home did the right thing and got rid of the threat?
All right, Hugh, let's get a response. I would hardly call this a nonsense thing.
Trayvon Martin thing, there wasn't the owner of, if he's talking about that case, he wasn't the owner of the home. It was an unarmed man who confronted an armed, in this case, Hispanic man. So we can't sort of make this purely about race, but it was somebody who interpreted the law there that he had the right to shoot him because he felt threatened, and I think that's very dangerous. But just on the general point the gentleman made, you know, if people who say that an armed, you know, we're all safer if we're all armed, then why don't opponents of gun control in the United States Senate take down those barriers that prohibit people from carrying guns onto the floor of the Senate? Why don't they take their logic and say, all right, if we're better off when we're all armed, let's arm the Senate. Let's arm everybody in Congress. Let's take down those barriers. They obviously don't believe that we want completely unrestricted access to guns everywhere. So we're not talking about disarming the country. We're talking about reasonable restrictions. And as I say to all my friends who are against all gun control laws, okay, take down those barriers at the Congress if that's what you really believe.
And the case that he was also referring to was a young man of mixed race who was at a party in Slinger, a Wisconsin suburb. There was drinking. It was underage. And the police came, and he ran next door to the neighbor's house and was in an enclosed porch area, which was part of the house. The owner heard commotion and took a gun and killed him on the porch.
It's a different story. For a second, I thought he was talking about the Trayvon Martin case.
Yeah,
but that I don't know anything about, so I'm not going to comment on. And look, again, if this person is a law-abiding person, then I am not saying this person shouldn't have a gun. None of us who support rational gun laws are saying that. What we are saying is we have to be more careful about guns as a country than we are, and that I really do not think America would be better off if everybody were armed. We disagree on that, I guess.
Yeah. We'll take one more call. I do want to ask, because I thought your piece on the Supreme Court and health care was very, very interesting, EJ. You write, if the court's conservatives overthrow the mandate, they will hasten the arrival of a more government-heavy system. You particularly point to Justice Kennedy's comments on this. Where do you think the court is going, and why are they becoming so heavily involved in a congressional decision?
Well, every smart person I know says they don't know what the court's going to do, and I don't want to be stupid and predict something flatly because I don't know. I mean, you can see two possible outcomes. One is a 5-4 conservative decision knocking down the mandate or knocking down the whole law. You can also see the possibility of a 6-3 decision the other way, because some of the things that Justice Kennedy said later on in the hearing suggested that it sort of accepts the idea that the healthcare market is simply not like every other market, especially since hospitals, I think rightly, have to treat people who come in need whether they have insurance or not. If you're run over by a car, they don't ask you first if you have insurance. They treat you first, and they should. But this creates a free rider problem, a finance problem, and he seemed to get that. And the general feeling among court watchers is that if Kennedy goes the other way and supports the mandate, then Chief Justice John Roberts will want to be part of that opinion, perhaps to pull it a little more to the right, or simply because he'd like to have a 6-3 decision as Chief Justice. I don't know which way it's going to go, but what I do know is the whole point of the mandate was to preserve a private market in health insurance. If we're going to have rules that say insurance companies are going to have to sell policies to people at a reasonable price, whether they have pre-existing conditions or not, and I think we should have that rule, then you really need everyone in the system, because otherwise people will game the system. And if you sort of throw all of this out, the logic is the only way constitutionally to do this, and the justices were very explicit about this, is to have a system like Medicare for everyone. So the paradox is, I think conservatives, by opposing the mandate, which they used to support, may hasten the day that we have a more government-oriented health system. I'm not 100% convinced, by the way, that would be the worst thing in the world. But if you're a conservative, it seems to me you want to preserve markets. And that's why Governor Romney signed such a law in Massachusetts. It's why a very smart guy called Stuart Butler at the Heritage Foundation started talking about the individual mandate back in the late 1980s. It's conservatives who wanted to save the private insurance market. And that's their idea.
We're going to go to Wisconsin. Just one final question for you. Are you following Wisconsin pretty closely?
And I think the whole country is. And by the way, I apologize to your listeners that I could only be with you a half hour today because of some other commitments.
That's okay.
But I hope I'm back.
Of course.
I think the recall in Wisconsin is a national story, has been a national story pretty much from the very beginning of the fight in the state legislature. I am hoping I can get out there before the vote, but it's a hugely important political confrontation. And so, yes, I think a lot of people in a lot of parts of the country are keeping their eyes on Wisconsin.
Yeah. Well, come to Milwaukee. We'll buy you a cup of coffee.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Thank
it's
you,
great
EJ.
To be with you, and thanks to your listeners, including the many who disagreed with me who didn't have a chance to talk back to me. Someday.
Thanks, EJ.
Take care.
EJ Dionne, who is, as you know, a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post. He's all over television. He's on NPR with David Brooks on Fridays. He is author of a number of books, including, he said, coming out in the next month, and we will book him for this, Our Divided Political Heart. He is a great guest and coming to Wisconsin, he says. We thought we would, because so much is going on in Wisconsin, devote our All Things Political to national commentary and to commentary from the state. Patrick Marley is joining us. Patrick is Madison Bureau reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm sure many of you saw yesterday's front page story. Front page story on how the Democratic candidates, and he focused really on the people who are deemed to be the front runners, Kathleen Falk and Tom Barrett, what those candidates' thoughts are on how much public workers should pay for benefits, on the whole issue of collective bargaining. We will certainly talk with him about that. And we will also, there's a front page story this morning, Daniel Bice's story, the biggest question hanging over Governor Scott Walker's recall election. Will Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm file additional criminal charges as part of his John Doe probe before the June 5 election? This is, of course, is secret, so nobody really knows for sure. But if there are more charges, does he, to appear fair, need to wait till after the June 5 election, or does he need to do it pretty much now, before, give enough time before the June 5 election? We will talk with Patrick about all of that. And welcome your phone calls as we switch now to state politics. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Patrick will be with us for the remainder of this hour. Hello, Patrick. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, I can hear you.
Okay, I had you on the wrong line, I believe. Okay. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, how are you?
Well, things are kind of busy your end of the phone, huh?
It's been that way for the last year and a half now, that's true.
Has it been a year and a half?
Almost. I mean, well, I guess a little over a year, because the budget repair bill came out in February of 2011.
Yeah. So you've been covering the Democratic candidates most recently with your story yesterday. Who's firing everybody up? Everybody? Or are we narrowing this to two front runners?
Well, I think the polling has shown pretty clearly we have two front runners in Tom Barrett and Kathleen Falk. We do have two other Democratic candidates in the race. But, you know, this race in particular has a very short timetable. Kathleen Falk was the first to get in January, right after the petitions against Walker were submitted. Barrett got in, was the last to get in. But candidates don't have a lot of ability to build up name ID like you would normally when you run for governor for almost 2 years now, seems to be the norm.
Right.
And so those two are both, you know, as well known statewide as one can be, and so they've also got the most money of anybody, from what we can tell, and so the race really seems to be a question of which of them is going to win the nomination.
Your story yesterday begins this way: how much public workers should pay for benefits is emerging as a new flashpoint in the Democratic race to see who will take on Scott Walker in the recall election for governor. Two questions: how do the candidates differ on this particular issue? And is this the key issue that will move people to the polls for the primary?
Well, we've known for some time that there were differences between Falk and Barrett about how they would approach restoring collective bargaining, but we hadn't really looked before at where they were on this issue. You know, Governor Walker did with his bill last year was essentially end most collective bargaining for most public workers, and along with that, it used to be that you would negotiate over what you pay in benefits, and he mandated a specific amount that was higher than what state workers had paid and what local workers had paid. And so the question we started looking at is what would Tom Barrett and Kathleen Falk try to do if they were governor? Would they keep the amount at the same levels that Walker said, or would they try to lower the amount workers paid? Tom Barrett says, look, the union leaders were always okay with having to pay more for their benefits, so we're going to keep it at that level. Kathleen Falk said she wants to open everything up to bargaining. There wouldn't be a state law mandating how much they pay, and they'd do it at the negotiating table.
Mm-hmm.
As to how much of that is going to be a factor in the race, obviously it's an issue that would be important to public workers. It may be a side issue for some other voters, but I think collective bargaining more generally is probably the bigger issue for both the primary and the general election.
And how do the candidates differ on that issue, Patrick?
Well, Kathleen Falk has said that she would put the restoration of collective bargaining back into her first budget, which would be introduced in 2013, that if the legislature did not send it back to her with that still in place, she would veto the entire budget and force the legislature to reconsider the budget. And Tom Barrett has said that's not the right way to go. He said there's too many aspects of the budget. You've got funding for Medicaid, you've got funding for education, you've got funding for all the state government in there, and that although he would do everything he could to try to restore collective bargaining, he would not take that step. He wants to call a special session of the legislature and try to get them to address it that way.
Mm-hmm. And when they're traveling around the state, do they devote equal time to issues like money for education, light rail, trains, voter ID, health care benefits, changes to Medicaid, etc.? Are those also prominent issues, Patrick?
Well, we haven't had a chance to get around with Tom Barrett yet because he's so new to the race. But both of them in their campaigning are touching on many issues. I think we saw in the Senate recalls last year that collective bargaining was not the issue that the average voter cares the most about, and so funding for education became a huge issue. I think that in this case, you'll see that funding for programs generally will be something that is focused on as much as, if not more than, collective bargaining. I think collective bargaining will be an important piece of this race. I think it's going to be bigger than it was in the Senate recalls because it's Walker himself who's on the ballot, and he's the one who came up with this plan. But like any race for governor, you're going to have sort of the whole array of issues that are going to be in play.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to phone calls in a moment. Our lines are getting crowded. I was also interested in Daniel Bice's story this morning. Will Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm file additional criminal charges as part of his John Doe probe before the June 5 election and all the political questions that are brought to the forefront here in terms of fairness, in terms of whether or not he is showing bias? What do you know about this? Are there likely to be more charges, and are there deliberations as to when those might happen?
Well, as Dan Bice mentioned in his story, John Chisholm, the DA in Milwaukee County, has indicated that there are more charges likely to come. Now, we don't know against whom, and we certainly don't know when. We don't know behind the scenes how much the upcoming election is playing into their decisions of when to charge. But that issue is going to be it's sort of a crucial piece of information to know for how the election's going to go. If there are significant charges against the governor or against some more of his top aides, that would be a real negative for him in an election that's coming up in just 2 months.
Do you think, though, considering how divided this state is and how people are adhering to their particular positions, it would make any difference?
Yes, I think it would make a difference, but I also think your point is a good one that, everybody in the state has a firm opinion of the governor. We've seen that through polling for more than a year. The people who support him tend to very strongly support him. People who dislike him have very strong feelings about him as well. And I think that he is the positions people, the opinions people have of him are so cemented that charges like that, that those who oppose him would say, you know, see, he's terrible and this is awful. People who support him would say, many of them would say, you know, this shows that it's just, this is all political and they're just trying to do everything they can to get him. It's a Democratic DA,
right,
and that sort of thing. But there are still people in the middle, and there are people whose opinions are going to be influenced about something like that if it were to happen, which, of course, we don't know if that would happen.
And who has indicated there will be more charges?
The district attorney has indicated that.
Okay. Well, let's go to phone calls. Want to?
Sure.
All right. Patrick Marley is our guest this half hour, Madison Bureau reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan is our first caller for you. Hi, Alan.
Hi. My comment is that I think the Kathleen Vineout is being marginalized by the press. When people on the radio come and say, well, the two front runners are, that's influencing people's opinion, and that's making the public think that they are the two front runners. The question of name recognition, I think, is really bogus, because the fact that Kathleen Falk and Barrett, whose name is recognized, especially up north, I think is going to hurt them in the election, where Vineout has strong support in the northern part of Wisconsin, and it's the 3% of the swing vote in the northern part of the state that's going to determine the election. And once the election takes place, whoever runs against Walker is going to have the name recognition. So I don't see why we're discounting viable candidates and spreading concern. It's, again, the reason behind, the power behind the recall was that there was a grassroots that was tired of being manipulated by the press and both political parties, and now we're facing the same thing with the big money that's going behind the two supposedly front-leading candidates.
And where are you from, Ellen?
Barneveld.
And is there strong support for Kathleen Vineout in that area?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And whenever she's gone to speak anywhere, if anyone has been to any of her forums with the other candidates, you'd see how she shines, how she's able to energize the people who are there, and why she has popular support amongst independents and moderate Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Patrick.
Yeah, I think that Kathleen Vineout is running a grassroots campaign. She... Her problem is she is not well known. She hasn't done advertising. She hasn't gotten her name out there beyond her Senate district so far. She has been traveling a tremendous amount, talking to voters. The supporters she has appear to be very devoted to her. But the fact is, in polling we've seen, you know, she's not getting anywhere near the support that Falk and Barrett are. There's a huge gap there that she would need to close, to get in contention. Now, as we've seen in Wisconsin politics in the last year, anything can happen. So she may yet catch fire. The same could happen with Secretary of State Doug La Follette, but so far that does not appear to have been the case. She hasn't, you know, one thing she has not done so far is introduced any specific plans that I've seen about what she's going to do differently than Falk or Barrett, and I think that's one way she could sort of crack through to media attention, is if she were to start laying out how she differs from the others in the race, what she would do that they wouldn't do, to sort of explain to voters why she should be the one that they should go for.
And she does face, as you have said, that it takes a while to have your name and who you are be known all over the state. There just isn't very much time in this race.
That's right. It's very difficult. I mean, Scott Walker ran for governor for essentially 6 years, because he ran for governor for 2 years in 2006 and more like a year and a half, and then he dropped out before the primary. And then as soon as Governor Doyle won re-election, he started going around the state and really did it for a very long time. Tom Barrett last time got in the race a little over a year in advance, and there was a lot of criticism from Democrats that he hadn't gotten in earlier. To get known, you got to travel the state a lot, and frankly, you got to spend a lot of money on TV advertising,
because
how most voters learn about candidates.
Yeah. Thanks, Alan, for the call. Jim in La Crosse. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing today?
All right, Jim. How are you?
Good. I would just like to make a comment. I do think Scott Walker has done quite a few good things for Wisconsin. Hi, how you doing?
Yeah, we're here. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I think part of it is that a lot of politicians, they run an honest, make themselves look really good, and ultimately it's just picking between the two evils, I guess, really.
You see both parties as being evil.
I don't think any of the parties are honest. I think they say what they need to say to get into office, and that's it. We need an honest candidate who's really going to do what they say.
All right. I think a lot of people share that feeling, Patrick?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, most people, when they are going to elect a president or a governor, often feel like they don't like the choices that they have, that there's just two, and they're not really choosing one so much as voting against the one they like least. And so, you know, whether that's the case in this election, I don't know. This election is appears to be much different than typical elections. Again, because the feelings about Scott Walker are so strong, both those who support him and those who oppose him.
So when we were talking earlier about people making up their minds on television commercials, in this particular race, they may know a little bit more than what they find out on television commercials?
Well, you know, one thing that people have been, you know, Governor Walker has a tremendous fundraising advantage. Now, there's going to be a lot of spending by his opponents. You know, the unions and other third-party groups are going to be spending. The candidates are going to spend their part. But the fact is, Governor Walker was able to raise a tremendous amount of money. His group supporting him, they have been punting a ton of money into advertising over the last year, particularly the last few months. And we have not so far seen tremendous changes in his standing in the polls. He's right at that 50% amount, and I don't know if advertising, it's going to be influential, but it's not perhaps going to be as crucial in defining him, because people already have opinions of him. Now, money that gets spent very well could define Barrett and Falk or another Democrat.
Yeah. We're going to continue phone calls in a moment. Patrick Marley is our guest for All Things Political this part of the show. He is Madison Bureau reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're, of course, talking about the recall, which is front and center in Wisconsin politics and national politics, as E.J. Dionne suggested earlier in this hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. The number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program today, a very interesting piece in The Atlantic. The title we'll tell you what we're going to talk about with the author of the piece. Is Facebook making us lonely? That's hour two. Mike in Kewaunee. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to say that I think the recall itself is a gigantic waste of money. And I'm a liberal. And my question is, regarding benefits that are paid for by the state or by the state employees, specifically the teachers, every teacher I talk to will say that their benefits come out of their salary, and there was a percentage that was allotted from their salary that to go towards their benefits. And now the main, every time you see the governor talking, he says now that the state employees are paying for their own benefits. I'd just like to know what exactly is the straight dope on that. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks,
Patrick. What's the straight dope?
So the benefits level that the governor required is that state, all public workers pay half of their pensions. Before, state workers did not pay any amount of their salary toward their pensions. That was entirely covered by the state or the school district. There were some exceptions to that, but that was generally true. Now they have to pay half that amount. So they're paying 5% of their salary toward their pensions. Separately, the amount that they pay for health care, their premium, was determined by negotiations, and that would differ from school district to school district and from for state employees. Now they're paying 12% of the premium, not 12% of their salary, but 12% of the premium has to be paid for the employee. That amounts to a reduction in total compensation for state workers of 7 or 8%. It's for the state, I don't know what it is for the local, but for the state government, it's a savings of about $300 million a year. So that's $300 million more the state workers are paying, $300 million less that state taxpayers are paying for those benefits for state workers.
Patrick, this issue, as you know, has been going on for a long time now in the state of Wisconsin. Do you have any sense, just a mere number of days before these primaries, Who's motivated? Are those who want the governor out of office kind of tired by all that's been going on for the past year? Are those who are supportive of the governor even more ardent in their support and just as likely to turn out to vote? Or is it a big question mark?
Well, I think it's a question mark, though. I from what I can tell, both sides are sort of firing on all pistons at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 2008, we saw the Democrats very fired up and a depressed electorate for the Republicans, and that showed with huge gains by the Democrats. And in 2010, the reverse was true with the Republicans and the Tea Party movement fired up, and they swept Wisconsin, they swept the country. It appears here that both sides are, you know, I mean, they got 930,000 signatures to recall Scott Walker, the first time it's ever something like that's ever happened in Wisconsin. At the same time, the Republicans are very motivated as well. Scott Walker gained a lot of volunteers to start going over recall petitions. And so I think we're going to see a tremendous turnout in the polls for an election.
Oh, I think you're right. We're going to have a huge turnout, I think. Let's go to Janice in La Crosse. Hi.
Wow, Kathleen, I'm a little, I can't breathless. I can't even speak. I'm a Republican. I'm conservative, and this has gotten to be so much pro Democrats that I can hardly stand it. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I am totally for Scott Walker. He was voted in to balance this budget, get us out of debt. That's what he's doing. People don't like it. They're screaming, "Ouch! I got to pay. How is it? You've been getting handouts forever, but now you got to pay. What do you know? Like the rest of us." So I'm like, keep it up, Scott Walker, and I hope he gets reelected. They should have let him not even do this silly, recall anyway. Save their money and wait a year and then vote someone else if you want. That's the democratic process. Go for it, people. Go for Scott Walker. Thank you. Goodbye.
All right, Janice. There are people who think that we ought to wait for the next go-around for an election who don't like the idea of a recall, and there are people on both sides who feel that way. Patrick, what do you say?
Yeah, there are a lot of people who feel that way. Obviously, Scott Walker supporters don't feel there should be a recall, but there's a number of people who maybe aren't a fan of his but say, well, he was given 4 years.
Right.
You know, the point the caller made about reducing the state's deficit is something that he campaigned relentlessly on. He did also campaign strongly on the issue of making public workers pay more for their benefits. He didn't talk about the collective bargaining issue generally. He said, we're going to make the painful cuts, and these are the choices that we have to do, and that's going to be a centerpiece of his campaign. I said I was going to fix the budget, and I have. Now, the Democrats are going to say he didn't really fix it, but he's going to be able to point to data that shows the size of the structural deficit is dramatically lower than it was. On the issue of getting rid of recalls, to do that, you're going to have to change the state constitution. It's going to be a big challenge. You've got to get that through the state legislature twice in two sessions in a row and then get it approved in a referendum. That could be difficult.
Let's go to Kevin on Highway 29. Hi, Kevin. Hi, Kevin.
We're talking about recalling the governor with the people who voted. Why don't we just say that only the people who voted in the original election have the right to cast the recall ballot to see if the voters really did change their mind? Thanks.
Again, it's all governed by the state constitution. The state constitution does not have any restriction on who can vote other than who can normally vote. You have to be 18, a resident of Wisconsin, not a felon. That's the way they set it up almost 100 years ago, and that's the way it's going to be until they change the state constitution.
It'd be pretty hard to tell people you can't vote if you didn't vote the last go around. You'd have a hard time with that. How important is this election in 30 seconds nationally?
As you heard E.J. Dionne say, it's very important. I think it's very closely watched. There could be ramifications here for how Obama performs in the fall. Mm-hmm. The unions are going to be spending money here that was ostensibly money that won't be spent in the presidential race. The ramifications are big.
A lot of national press on its way or already here.
I'm actually surprised we haven't seen more of them. I'm sure we will in the next 60 days.
I'm sure. Patrick, thank you. What are you working on today?
Photo ID. We've got one of the photo ID cases starting today.
Oh, it is? All right. Yeah. Always something, sir. It's always something. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Patrick Marley, Madison Bureau reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Earlier, E.J. Dionne, senior fellow, Brookings Institution, syndicated columnist, Washington Post author, has a new book coming out. He informed us and said he'd be happy to come on the show and talk about that, and we'd be happy to have him, so we will schedule that. He'll be with us again in about a month. And just a reminder to you that All Things Political takes place Mondays at 9. We've been doing this for years now. Years and years. We've been through a lot of elections together, and there are more to come. So we'll be with you for All Things Political again next Monday. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Brett Jaspers, our new producer, for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios.